Our world has become complex and disruptive, and leading teams and organizations takes courage, determination, and skill. This podcast connects you to some of the great leaders to find out just how they do it. You're listening to Russell Boyce and Daryl Crook in conversation with standout leadership in a world of disruption.
Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Daryl Crook, and together with my colleague Russell Boyce, we have the pleasure of speaking with Andrew Monahan. Andrew has spent the last 20 or so years as a senior manager and then a member of the executive team with Qantas. Of course, Qantas is not only one of the world's great airlines, but also an Australian icon. Welcome, Andrew.
Thanks, Daryl.
Andrew, if you wouldn't mind, just give our listeners perhaps a couple of quick stats around Qantas. I'm sure they've heard of it. It's one of the great airlines, but how many staff, how many aircraft, how many domestic flights a year, international flights a year, those sort of things, just so we can get a bit of context around this wonderful organisation.
A number of aircraft we've got, it's fairly fluid because we retire and procure aircraft, but it's in the order of about 300. And Qantas is actually made up of several airlines. Qantas Group owns what we call internally Qantas Airlines, but it also owns the low-cost carrier Jetstar and the regional branded airlines called QantasLink. And in the QantasLink brand alone, there's three separate airlines that serve different markets. We do approximately 1,000 departures a day. And that's domestic, and then several hundred international departures a day, carrying tens of millions of passengers per year. There's about 25,000 staff. Most of those are Australian based, in sort of the mid 90s, maybe 95% of staff. The staff that aren't based here are based in ports that we fly to internationally.
Wow, that's some really big numbers there. 1,000 flights a day domestically, and I think you said 300 flights a day internationally. That's enough to keep anybody on their toes. Andrew, we're keen to listen to your story to open up today's podcast. So, you know, start where you want to start and finish with where you're sitting today, and tell us that wonderful story about what got you to where you're at.
I might start by saying that you can be very self-indulgent looking back on your career and say it was all well planned and I made this decision then and that resulted in this. And Steve Jobs has got a great story about looking backwards. He calls it joining the dots. I will share where I came from and where I am. And maybe through that I'll weave through where I think I made some conscious decisions about the future. But I think the reality is for most people, you make decisions on the information that is in front of you and it takes you on a journey and it's not necessarily well planned. So I'll tell you where I came from and where I went to, and it will sound like a story that's all well joined up, but it didn't necessarily feel that at the time. Basically, I think my career thinking started when I was a kid. I'm the oldest of four kids in a conventional household out in Western Sydney. We lived in an asbestos house that was about 11 squares, really cold at night, really hot in summer. And we would, through winter, spend about 2 or 3 hours each night after school just chopping wood to keep the house warm. We had an open fire. And I'm going to use that analogy later because I learned a lot chopping wood. There's some good learnings for our senior management in the craft of chopping wood. But it was about 16. I came home from school one day and my dad said, you know, you're going into year 11 and 12, what do you want to do? And I said, I actually don't know, but I think I want to run a factory and I want a company car and it's going to be a blue Ford Fairmont. That's all I know. He came home the next night with a book called Kaizen, which was a book of that was sort of Western ideas taken out of learnings in Japan. And Kaizen means small and incremental improvement. And that's how the Japanese had kind of developed manufacturing out of World War II. So he brought that home to say, if you want to run a factory, you kind of want to know how to improve things. Doors open, doors close. I don't remember making these decisions, but I think that's one of the conscious decisions that, around setting goals. I ended up doing engineering. I ended up doing, after I got my degree, a role called as a field engineer, which basically meant I had a massive toolbox. And I worked across America, across Australia, and across New Zealand fixing machines. And with my hands, even though I had a degree, I was kind of working as a tradesman. And I was fixing hydraulic systems, pneumatic systems, electrical systems, mechanical systems. And it was tough. So, you know, I was a young 20-year-old turning up to a factory with 1,000 people standing watching because the machine had broken down. And in the first 12 months, I think I spent 11 nights at home. And I worked out I didn't like that. I didn't like living in hotels. So I started looking for a role, and they were looking for an assistant factory manager out in Western Sydney. I got the role. It was a huge factory. It was 12 acres under roof. And it had 12,000 part numbers, 40,000 processes. And in the front door, we'd bring copper wire, steel, bauxite. And out the back end, we would have generators, welding equipment, stick electrode, MIG wire, all that type of stuff. Pretty rare in Australia. I was working for a company that was 120 years old, based out of Cleveland, Ohio. And Australia was the first subsidiary they had in 1957. I quickly got promoted. By the time I was about 27, I was general manager of the manufacturing division. I was learning the craft of being a leader. And it's funny, most people I spoke to in the factory just assumed I was 40, even though I looked young. They just had this association with the more senior you are, the older you are. And I had some rough things to deal with through that period. There was the Asian economic crisis. 30% of what we exported, manufactured, was exported into Asia. So we had some real restructuring going on. This firm I worked for had an inferred guaranteed job for life type of philosophy. And we had to do the first redundancy in its history, which was tough for, 20-odd-year-old. I, not long after that, decided, and this is another one of those conscious decisions around the future. So the first one, oh, by the way, here I was, a factory manager. I had a blue Ford Fairmont company car, and that is no word of a lie.
Well done.
So the next kind of profound decision I made, and they came together, were, wow, if I'm going to hang around this manufacturing, I better get a bit more sophisticated about how to fix things. So I got deep into Six Sigma and deep into lean manufacturing as a knowledge-based thinking. That's got to be a skill that I personally have that can be applied elsewhere, but it can also help the factory. The other decision I made not long after that, in my early 30s, was I wanted to touch stuff other than operations. I wanted to touch finance at some point. And I also wanted to sort of be a bit more customer facing at some point. But that was a long-term goal. But it's funny how you put goals out there. When doors open and doors close, your subconscious is just constantly working in your favor to achieve those goals, in my view. So not long after that, I was in my mid-30s, I got a call from a recruiter saying that there was a job going in Canberra, general manager operations. I said, why would I want that? I'm just general manager operations in Sydney. Awesome job. Went to the interview. They said it's Qantas. As an airport manager, I said, that's interesting. That ticks the customer-facing box. We'll pick up and move. But it was a massive, massive move. My wife equally had a career at the time. She gave up work. We had a one-year-old son. My wife was pregnant with our daughter. And we, because we had a mortgage in Sydney, we couldn't afford to live in or rent in Canberra. It was the bushfires had gone through and knocked out several hundred homes, and the rental market was horrendous. So we moved to a town 50 kilometres out of Canberra. And Russell will probably be aware of this town. It's halfway between Canberra and the Australian snowfields, a place called Mikalago. It's a town of 26 houses. And we rented the general store's house that was out the back. And our address was the general store, Main Street, Mikalago, no number. That was our address. Anyway, I would drive 50 Ks to and from work during that time. Won't spend too much time on this. My daughter ended up having a reflux condition for 6 months, and my wife suffered pretty acute postnatal depression. And we were kind of, we didn't have a lot of social support because we moved to a new town and I was in a new company and didn't know many people. So it was a really tough period and a period where I dug really deep and consciously decided, how am I going to build personal resilience? And I built my own 5-step process. And I'll share very quickly what that process is, because the first one is step one is you have a choice. You're either the victim or the leader of circumstances happening to you. The circumstance happens, but your choice, I'm sorry, is what are you going to do about it? The easiest analogy is you're driving down the road and someone cuts you off. You can choose to get really angry about that, or you can choose to say, they're obviously in a rush, I'm going to let them in. And same situation, different outcome based on how your attitude to that event. The second is making sure that you're building stories around how you've got through stuff before, because it's important. We all do go through dramas and deal with things differently, but it's good to remind yourself. The third one is perspective. And we lose perspective when we're stressed. Our world, I remember waking up and my world was basically a 20-cent piece in Australia, that size. Everything else was black, and that's just stress. So perspective, I would pick the newspaper up each morning and go, gee, I'm not on the front page. It's not that bad. The next one is building a support network. No one goes alone. And the last one is stay fit, healthy, and eat well. And that five worked for me. And we got out of there. Not long after that, about 18 months later, the decision that I'd made years ago to understand Lean and Six Sigma really played off, because Qantas was looking in their strategy department for a practice lead for Lean and Six Sigma. And so I applied. And I got the role essentially because not only did I have the practice of that, I knew operations, and it would mean that I came at that with a level of credibility that other operational leaders could talk to you about their problems, and you could relate. I then quickly moved around the organization. So I had a team, and we would go and spend 6 months in different parts of the business and just help the business improve. And then I got offered several roles, but didn't take them, but I did take one role that was offered to me in our corporate shared services area. And going back to the goals, that was also running our finance area of Qantas. And it was kind of, so tick the box of customer facing, and this was going to tick the box for how does an engineer get into finance. This was my way, because I was running the finance operation. Went in there, worked on fixing things, improving processes. And ultimately ended up running the show. So by then I was reporting to the CFO at Qantas, running our corporate services, which was finance, supply chain, our HR functions, and supply chain, and a few IT support type things. I did that for a few years and then was asked by the CFO to look at the operating model of finance and do some sort of redesign there. So I set up a team, and we completely lifted the operating model on its head, redesigned it, set up a centralized finance accounting department, and what have you. Not long after that, I got asked to run internal audit at Qantas, with a view to retaining the audit function, but helping the organization through doing health checks, which was a way of taking the audit capability and applying that knowledge to actually go in and help the business do things better, particularly around programs. I then was asked to run HR for Australia for a period. Someone had left and someone new wasn't coming on for 6 months, so I stepped out of the audit role and ran HR. And that then bled into the next role, which was running industrial relations for the group. But I had a condition going into that one. I said, if you want me to run IR, I'm not staying there forever. So 2 years is enough. And to their credit, after 2 years, I was then asked to go and set up a safety shared services function at Qantas. And it was around about that time, or maybe a couple of years before, that I made another conscious decision. So you can see there's a lot of subconscious decisions going on in my life, but I've kind of had, when I look back, three or four milestone ones that I decided to get deep into aviation. I really understand how aviation held together, particularly from a regulatory perspective, because it's quite complex. It's a highly regulated industry. Australia's a mature player in the international game of aviation. It's been around for 100-odd years. So I've got a deep knowledge. And what I would do is every Friday morning, I would have a breakfast with two guys in the organization that were nearing retirement. One had a heavy engineering background, aviation, and one had been a pilot for a long time, but it was elsewhere. And I just used to deep soak with those guys as well as do reading. And they loved it as well. They loved sharing. And so I made that conscious decision. So ran the shared services for safety service for a while, and then I got asked to be chief operating officer for QantasLink, chief operating officer for Qantas. During COVID, I stepped out of my day job and became the group crisis chair. So working, helping the organisation bring the network down to zero as state and international borders closed. Then, as we came out of COVID, I was asked to step in and run safety, security, sort of our compliance functions for the group. And then there was a change in CEO last year, and I was asked to step into the role I'm in today, which is Chief Risk Officer, which is basically the mandate is keep the organisation operationally running against our safety management system, but start to apply the safety management system thinking to other parts of the enterprise to bring that sort of discipline to play. That's where we are. That's the journey.
My goodness. I mean, that is the most amazing story. And I bet that Russell has a dozen questions lined up ready as he is tend to do.
I've been madly scribbling them, Daryl. But I was tempted to facetiously suggest, Andrew, that you've given us no lines of inquiry whatsoever. What a boring life. No, just kidding, just kidding. Can I lead with a question? I'm fascinated by your role as Chief Risk Officer, but I want to, and I'll ask about that eventually, but I want to go right back to you working effectively as a tradie, or for international listeners, a tradesperson. That I'm guessing that hands-on experience gave you street cred. And street cred in the eyes of others, and self-confidence inside yourself, and empathy for the people who work for you. Is that true? Did you find that you were able to engage in conversation and make connections and have empathy for what's going on in other people's lives because of that experience?
Think so. And look, it's probably due credit to the organization I was working for because they were recruiting professional university educated engineers and putting them into There was a very fast training program to bring you up to speed, but they saw the benefit of that for, I assume, for future leadership. Obviously, I left that industry, but definitely because you're on the tools, you're walking and talking with the people that actually do things, and I think that that helps understand what motivates people. It certainly helps you connect with people. And it's funny, you know, you can go and do a degree. I'm sure I got that job because what I haven't shared is, I mean, my hobby is restoring sort of muscle cars from the late 60s to the early 70s, including more recently into the Japanese cars of that era as well. And knowing you guys are global, you know, the Datsun 240Z, it's a global car, but it was a big sort of thing for Nissan Datsun at the time to come out with that car. I think I got the job because they looked at what my hobby was as much as what my degree was, and they said he's a guy who can, you know, use spanners, and he's got the engineering degree. So I think that, you know, you can't underestimate the things that you may not consider are valuable in the workplace, because perhaps they are. And that's maybe about stepping back and taking a more comprehensive view of what are your skills, and it's not always obvious that those skills are the skills that are in demand. Yeah, but that was a foundational for me, and it has stayed with me ever since. When I ran the factory, I spent half the time out on the floor. I would do shifts with the teams. I remember night shift was short of a supervisor, so for about 3 months, I became the night shift supervisor as well. So just I think that helps solve problems, and it helps particularly with work groups. It brings a level of getting to the real issues fast because you're not having to build trust. The trust is already there. And so, you know, you're really just talking about the issues that matter. So that's why I think credibility is important. And I know there's lots of talk about the power of trust in workplaces, but I truly think if you can build trust, it is the best tool for driving efficiency because you don't need to constantly build context. The context is not needed because there's trust there. So I think working on the tools help with that as well.
Andrew, I'm going to bottle that last statement about trust. That is gold right there for our listeners. And I think as a management consultant myself, I understand deeply the importance of that. From engineers, through finance, through HR, through industrial relations, through safety, through aviation, through chief operating officer, and now into chief risk officer, and I probably missed a couple along the way. Can you take a few minutes to tell us about your leadership style, how it has emerged, developed, evolved, and what you've learned along the way around what works and what doesn't work in leadership behavior?
I think behavior matters a lot, and I treat every single interaction as an opportunity for it to be positive for the other person. I consciously do that because I think people underestimate, but you know, a lot of people ensure interactions up the tree are managed, and sometimes don't bother about elsewhere. I think that treating everyone with respect is really important. That's been a foundation of how I operate. I'm not saying it's a great way, but it's certainly the way I operate. I know the people that do every different role in the organization, from the CEO right through the organization. And I'm not going to describe what end of the spectrum because I'm not going to place value on certain roles over others, but I think every interaction matters. The person that's bringing you the mail is just as an important interaction for me as anything else. So I do share that. Every interaction matters. It's not, and by that I don't mean it's staged, it's authentic, but it's considered. You just don't blindly go into interactions because there's a human on the other end of that interaction, and they're coming with their own paradigm to that. So the best way to cut through paradigms is just a sense of authenticity in my mind. So that's the first thing. I think the second thing is walk the floor. Walk the floor. Get to know people. in as organizations become more and more matrixed, and there's less and less power gradients through the authority, and less positional authority because of, you know, resource constraints, the skill to manage is the ability to influence for outcomes where you don't have positional authority. And that in organizations means building trusting relationships. So you can pick the bat phone up to someone that's got nothing to do with you do, but they can help you and they will help you because you've already got a trusting relationship. I think that's an important trait now and more so going forward. I think that organizations are going to be, they've been on this journey for 20, 30 years, and I don't think that's slowing. I think that rate of interdependency is increasing. And that's probably not even just true in organizations. It's probably right through your baggy chains. The one trait that I've had to learn, sort of let's say in the last 5 years, that I'm not good at, but I just had to, was compartmentalization. So the more complex and diverse meetings you're having, or portfolios you're looking after, or stakeholders, if you want to have a very mindful and focused and respectful meeting with someone, then you've got to be 100% there. You can't be worrying about what happened in the last meeting. And so that's easy. Compartmentalization, I think, is easier said than done. Some people are better than others. And some people mask compartmentalization by actually not caring. So I think the combination of caring but being able to be fully focused and in the moment requires a little bit of compartmentalization. There's lots of corporate buzzwords around inclusion and diversity and all that sort of stuff. I truly believe in diversity and inclusion in its broadest sense. And I think that is evidenced wherever you go. You can look at any movie, any book that is successful, and it will be made up of a team of characters that are completely different, that play to one another's strengths. They don't play to their weaknesses. They don't play to the average. They play to their extreme strengths, each individual, and then they win, right? That is how every movie plays out. So there's something in it. And so consciously including people, I think, is important for a leader. And sometimes that means actively reaching out and encouraging people to speak. Because there's lots of good thinkers there that aren't necessarily forcing their voice to the table, you know, introverts, what have you. And I am a natural introvert, so I have had to learn to have a voice at the table through a few little tricks that introverts can have up their sleeve.
Andrew, can you tell us some of those tricks? I myself, in some ways, am an off the chart introvert.
Yeah,
I find it difficult at the table sometimes.
Yeah,
tell us.
There's two main ones for me, but I would say there's a common misunderstanding in my view that introverts take longer to think through the problem and need to dwell on things. I actually think in many cases it's the opposite. I think that introverts have evaluated all the inputs, the variables, got an idea, but don't need to be talking through that process. For me, become good at something and known for that thing that's different to other people around the table, and therefore when you speak, everyone listens. Is one, and it doesn't have to be a technical skill. It can be a skill of, actually, I know what the troops are thinking at the moment, or I know what the shop floor's thinking. That in itself is skill. And the other one is, if you haven't got much to say, ask the profound question that no one's asked. That gets a cut through. There's lots of others, but I would say, if I was to summarize, those two are pretty easy to do. They don't need that much courage, and it then helps the next time because, that was a good question, or wow, I know that person will probably have a perspective that matters on this that's different to everyone else.
Asking questions causes people to think, reflect, and realize in ways that telling them things does not cause them to think or reflect or realize them. The power of asking questions. I was just going to ask, Andrew, you've touched sort of tangentially. The focus there is on people, and I absolutely applaud that from a leadership point of view. But you've just touched tangentially on issues around values and ethics. Would you just take a moment for us? Values-based leadership, ethically-based decisions, having to make some of those tough calls because of those values and those ethics.
Yeah, that's obviously important. And it's interesting, isn't it, now that universities teach ethics and even companies teach ethics. Why do we have to teach ethics? It's an interesting question. Why haven't we already got ethics? I think it's important. It's becoming more important, and all stakeholders expect it. Investors expect good ethical decisions. Regulators to external to your organisation, whether that's customers or suppliers and your own people, expect that. I think for me, it's less about the ethics and it's more about making sure you understand how you make decisions. So in my particular case, there is a spectrum from beliefs based through to pure analytics. Some people just look at data and can make a decision. And then there's others that say the data can tell me that, but the beliefs is there. So I'm on the beliefs end of that when I go and do this. But there's people on my team that are at the other end. And I think the trick is, and we consciously lean into this, is we talk collectively before we make a decision so that we get that different perspective and ensure that we're conscious of the different biases that come into decision making. I know, Daryl, you're all over the biases associated with decision making. I think it's biases definitely play out in decision making, and the answer is to make sure that you acknowledge that there could be bias in there and try to introduce a process to at least flesh that out and get as many alternate views in there, before decisions are made.
Brilliant.
So, Andrew, what can we segue from that but draw some threads through your chief risk officer? And some people would think that risk means, is there a risk that the plane is going to crash?
Yeah.
However, that's just one very small part of it. I'm imagining that the role of the chief risk officer is ensuring that the company is aware of what's coming over the horizon.
Yeah.
And is grappling, is ideating that, is grappling with how you defend against that if it's an attack. It could be an attack, a corporate attack. It could be an economic attack. It could be a pandemic. It could be a workforce trend, whatever it might be. And how do you then create options to go on the front foot and become disruptors rather than disrupted? Is that part of your role? And if so, how do you take people with you on that journey?
Yeah, so I might just start by saying I think that the way we think about risk is that you're trying to avoid hazards is one side, protect, and that's, to your analogy in aviation, that's putting people in planes and ensuring that they land where we said they'd land. But the other end of the spectrum is opportunities. And how do you extract maximum value from the opportunity without tipping over the edge? And you do that with information systems and good decision making. And so they're two sides of the same coin in my view. There's various mechanisms and frameworks out there to think about risk. At Qantas, we think about risk, the approach of considering those hazards And those opportunities through three sort of pillars. The first pillar is just a conventional risk assessment approach, which is what's the likelihood of something happening that you're looking at, and what's, sorry, the likelihood and the consequence, and map those out on a matrix. And then you say, okay, ones that are kind of likely and high consequence, well, you better have lots of controls around there. And organisations are moving quite formally to sort of three lines of defence, assurance and all that type of thing. So the more hazardous and the less likely you want it to happen, the more assurance you want. From a safety perspective, that's why all airlines in the world have comprehensive safety management systems that are multi-layered to ensure that things don't go wrong and people know what they're doing. The second is sort of strategic risks, which is what are those things that are kind of coming at you that you can see. You're not sure if they're going to come your way and how quickly. There's this concept of risk velocity, which is how quickly are things coming at you, that uses a little bit of it, a different approach, because you're not sure about the likelihood. Likelihood's not as clear. You can also apply that to something that's just happened. So if you have an event that's just happened, you might have thought it was very rare for it to happen, but it happened. So how do you assess that? And then the third type is over the horizon stuff that's coming at you that you may not have thought about, and that's a different approach. Again, that's using things like wargaming and things like that, and that can be used for both hazards coming at you or opportunities coming at you. But they're all about how do you extract value without crossing the line, and that line being a line defined by yourself in terms of where you want to go. There's a whole heap of other apparatus that sits around that. So listed companies in Australia have to have a risk appetite statement, which describes on various domains where's the risk tolerance. So that's mandatory. That's a working document for some organisations. For others, it's kind of a statement for shareholders and senior management. That's kind of how we think about it. Obviously, for airlines, the safety management system is very comprehensive, but easy to understand. So in the organisation I work for, the five pillars of the safety management system are really easy to understand. So the front line through CEO gets it, and all it is leadership and commitment, which is all about knowing what your role is, role clarity, understand your processes, and the more important the process, then the more you know about it. What risks and hazards does that process come into contact with? How do you manage those? How do you assess them? What are your lead lag indicators? The fourth domain is assurance, so checking that your processes are working and people know what they're doing and that you're assessing your risks. And then the last one is training, promotion, and communication, making sure people are trained appropriately, that we're promoting the aspects of keeping the process sound appropriately, and that it's clearly communicated to those that need to know. And off that hangs quite a complicated apparatus, but you can see from its simplicity, it's easy to kind of get your head around. And that's really important. And the thing I would say, and I can't leave this topic without talking about it, is the most important element to a safety management system is the concept of psychological safety, which is hazards are identified and escalated in a way where that is made to feel as a safe thing to do, to raise that. And there's a whole heap of other stuff that hangs around that, like just culture. If there's an incident, how did the system allow the incident? How did the person make a mistake? We look at how did the system let that person down? So that's how all that hangs together. That's a long-winded answer for what's risk, where I am, but that's kind of it in a nutshell.
It's a brilliant answer and a brilliant analysis of the risk. For that part of risk, that's the incoming stuff coming at you with with varying velocity, and the over the horizon stuff that you can't yet see, but you need to try to anticipate it. That's seriously high altitude strategic thinking that's required there. And you mentioned earlier in the conversation the need for diversity and lack of bias and so on. So you need multiple people tackling in that. So how do you find such people, get them into a room, get them thinking in that direction, and collectively ideating and teasing out those incoming risks?
Some of it's where I am. Some of it's formal. So we have certainly on the security, geopolitical, and local threat landscapes, deep relationships with intelligence agencies and what have you, and actually a team that just are dedicated to that, who have come out of that industry. So that's an example of a domain where you've got very specialized and diverse and far-reaching. And this is why it's going to feel like a little bit of a winding road. It depends on the thing. So we will use in aviation, we use other trusted airlines for some stuff. In other areas, there's lots of forums for airlines. In fact, there's IATA, which has, you know, most airlines in the world are a part of. That is about an information sharing as well as sort of policy and regulatory thinking. And then there's senior leaders in the organization that are also well networked, that look at things and network with people so they get that diverse input. And then there are external providers that can provide a perspective. And then there's a range of those things. So the World Economic Forum put out a document every couple of years looking at these are the key risks for corporates over the next 2 years, and they got a time domain of the next 10 years, right? So, and how is that changing? So there's no one answer. It depends, and it's relying on different perspectives, different views, and different expertises depending on the domain we're looking at. And the trick is not to miss a domain. And so that's why when you think about risk, you kind of want to have a convention that captures domains you're interested in, or so you don't miss any. That can't just be an ad hoc type of thing. You got to structurally work through what are all of these, even if they're low risk and nothing's happening with them. Yeah.
Andrew, two quick questions from me as we come to close here. And the first one is, you know, we're talking about leadership in a disruptive world. If you were a betting man, or you were able to have a look at the airline industry, what for you are the major disruptions coming toward the airline industry? How will we see it change dramatically, if at all, over the next 5-10 years?
There's a couple of things coming at aviation generally. The first is, it's very hard to fly a heavy aircraft a long way without using a fuel source that we use today. So there's a lot of work going into what's called sustainable aviation fuels, which is basically creating an ecosystem where you pull carbon out of the atmosphere into a crop that doesn't compete with food agriculture, and that crop itself gets converted into aviation fuel. So that's we'll call that a disruptor, but that is something that is coming at the industry. It's demanded more and more by customers, and it's getting demanded more and more by investors, right? That is a thing. Related to that is flying technology. So there will be electric powered planes. The thing is, they can't make batteries light enough for them to carry heavy loads long ways. So what we will see most likely is short sector flying point to point with electric aircraft. We're going to see more drones flying around. And so that's an airspace consideration for airlines globally. We are going to see more pilot schools because we're kind of, as an industry, seeing as aviation grows, there's a retirement crest coming that means, I think CAPA have stated this, something like 400,000 pilots will be trained globally in the next 10 years. And so that, how does the system of aviation deal with that amount of training? It's a lot of training. And training, you know, you don't take shortcuts in training. So it's comprehensive and it's thorough. And then there's some sort of stuff I describe globally more at the edges, and that is certainly on international travel, there's a propensity that we're seeing for more point-to-point flying. So in other words, smaller gauge aircraft flying longer distances so that people go from wherever they want to go to wherever they want to go without going through so many stops on the way. That's, there'll always be hubs, but COVID has probably accelerated that. We were drifting that way anyway, but COVID's definitely drove that, the propensity for customers to want to go point to point. So beyond that, it's hard. The last thing I'll say is the capital life cycle of an aircraft is so long. Let's call it, it's at least a decade. Most airlines, it's 2 decades. You can't make decisions based on 1 or 2 years from a capital outlay perspective. You've got to have a plan that plays out over multiple decades. So you're more likely to be disrupted around the things I've mentioned, but also then distribution or how you connect with customers and how they choose to play with you as a brand is where the most amount of wouldn't say disruption, but the most amount of innovation will go.
A very quick answer, a very quick question, and a quick answer. If you're able, and you're a bit better man than I am, if you can give a quick answer to it, Andrew. But years in leadership, so many leadership experiences, so much leadership knowledge and growth within you. If you were talking to some young folks who said, what's one lesson that you can give me, one piece of advice you can give me if I'm really interested in taking this leadership journey, what would it be for you, Andrew?
I'll answer that twofold. One is to accept that you can do all the planning in your world, but the journey's probably not, you're probably going to follow a slightly different path. Just embrace it, go with it. And everything's not about, if you're early in your career, everything's not about a trajectory that starts low and goes in this linear lineup. It's a rocky road that has ups and downs. And that's the fun of it. So the way to think about that and frame it is it's a roller coaster ride, which is exciting. That's probably the most important thing. The second one is you are going to have hard times in your life, whether that's at home, with your family, or at work in your career. You got to find a way of not walking away from those problems, but getting through them. And my mantra for that, and I tell my kids all the time, the bigger mountain we're climbing means it's a bigger drama, but the bigger the treasure on the other side. And just tell yourself it's true.
Andrew, thank you. Final word from Russell.
Andrew, this has been fascinating.
Yeah.
My own experience with the aviation sector, so much of what you said, it both rang true as well as opened new eyes for me. And thanks for those insights for me and for everybody listening.
Andrew Monahan, thank you so much for being our guest today. We greatly appreciate your insight and wish you well in your endeavours.
Well, thank you very much for allowing me. All the best.